Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to take a look at my personal favorite movie, and I'm sure, you know, we'll find out how much John loves it, whether or not John loves it more than me, by Akiva Goldsman, who is an executive producer and writer on Star Trek Discovery. And that movie is the 1995 masterpiece. Batman Forever. So...
Starting early. Okay.
So Batman Forever. This is the third film in the what originated with the
Burtonverse.
Tim Burton. Yeah, the Burtonverse. It's the first movie to not be directed by Tim Burton and not star Michael Keaton. It was directed by Joel Schumacher, and it stars Val Kilmer as Batman, as well as Jim Carrey as the Riddler. Tommy Lee Jones as Two-Face.
Yes.
Chris O'Donnell as Robin.
Yes.
And Nicole Kidman as Dr. Chase Meridian.
Yes.
And it was...
And a very fine pursuit indeed, yes.
And it was written by Lee Batchelor, Janet Scott Batchelor, and Akiva Goldsman.
Yeah, ampersand on the first two names and the word and... on Akiva Goldsman.
Yeah, and they're credited, you know, the Batchelors are credited with the story as well, so theoretically they wrote the early drafts, and then Goldsman was brought on to rewrite at some point. That's what it seems to be. And Goldsman has written a lot of movies, but this was very early on in his career. He had written two movies which came out the year before, Silent Fall and The Client, which was another Joel Schumacher movie. And then this came out in 95. So it's only his third movie. Do you want to give a synopsis of this movie?
Oh, I sure do, Mike.
Okay.
I sure do. We find ourselves in a Gotham City that has recuperated from its ordeals with Joker, Catwoman, and Penguin, and found itself in the middle of a day-glow nightmare at the hands of Two-Face, also known as Harvey Dent, a half-purple Tommy Lee Jones with some interesting fashion choices. And Batman swings in, blah, 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 and then Jim Carrey becomes the Riddler. And as we love to say on this show, hijinks ensue.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a new love interest for third love interest for the third movie with Batman and slash Bruce Wayne, spoilers. And, you know, basically the antics of going around and trying to protect Gotham from two supervillains who fall into league with each other after the Riddler discovers that he can suck brain power out of people.
Yes. Okay, so here's my question for you, first and foremost.
Yes.
Do you remember seeing this movie for the first time?
You betcha I do.
Do you remember the exact circumstances, or can you describe?
Yes, I was actually in a movie theater in Williamsburg, Virginia. Not Colonial Williamsburg, because they don't have movie theaters in Colonial Williamsburg, because that would not be time period accurate.
Mm.
And so we were in Greater Williamsburg, and I was visiting my cousins, and we went and we saw Batman Forever, because my brother and I are both big Batman fans. And I remember seeing it in the theater. And I remember being somewhat silent afterward, and my cousin, Julie, asking me, like, looking at me and saying, "So did you like it?" And I remember looking at her and saying, "Yeah, actually I did. That was fun. It was a bit lighter than Batman Returns. I had a good time." And that was my first. What was your first experience seeing it?
My first experience, I mean, I guess here's my question. You were a fan of the Burton Batman movies?
Oh, very much so. I even my enthusiasm to defend Batman Returns has fallen off greatly in the most recent years, because as I've revisited it, I found that it didn't hold up as well as I thought it would. But the phrase I used to love saying was that Batman Returns was a Freudian psychodrama as a comic book. But I adored the 1989 Batman. I mean, you know, nostalgically, I still do. Still adore it. I still think it's a fantastic movie and terrific fun to watch. So, yes, I was a huge fan of the series.
Yeah, I was 15 when Batman Forever came out. I had just kind of discovered comics with, like, the death of Superman, basically. And I had been hanging out at a comic book store very, very frequently. And as an extension of sort of like my love for Batman, which, you know, happened with... It was weird. Like, the thing that got me hooked on Batman was Nightfall, the Bane story.
Oh, yeah.
But
yes.
It wasn't the comics. I actually read the novelization that Denny O'Neil wrote.
Nice.
Which came out afterwards. And
not a bad choice.
That was actually, it was really, really helpful because in addition to getting the whole story and sort of like fine-tuned into, you know, like one complete volume, the other thing that it did was obviously it being written for a more mainstream audience, it really had to sort of like lay the groundwork of Batman. And I'm not just talking about, you know, the origin where his parents are shot in the alley, because obviously everyone knows that. But, yeah. You know, sort of like there's so many characters in Nightfall, you know, like Two-Face shows up, let's say, and, you know, they need to explain who Two-Face is, because in the comics, it's just like, Two-Face is back, oh no. But in this book, they had to be like, Two-Face, you know, Two-Face was a guy who had acid poured on his face and blah, blah, blah. You know, and that was actually like really, really great, you know, thinking about it, because it basically gave me all the information that I needed to know about the larger Batman mythology.
Yes.
So that when I started reading the comics, which I did, you know, go back and read the entire Nightfall storyline, and then I continued to read Batman comics for years after that, it you know, really sort of gave me everything that I needed. So, you know, that got me hooked on Batman, and then of course I watched, in addition to the animated series, the Tim Burton Batman movies and everything, and I really did love those. And because of that, I was really looking forward to Batman Forever. And I was just starting to get into movies. You know, Generations had just come out a few months prior. And that was the first movie that I was ever, like, actively anticipating, you know, went to see on opening night. And the second movie was Batman Forever. You know, I was counting down the days. I had this amazing T-shirt with, like, the question mark with the bat logo in the middle, which now you can get off of Warner Brothers' website again. I need to get that shirt. You know, things like that. You know, I had posters up in my walls and everything. Sure. I could not wait to see this movie, you know? And everyone who worked at the comic book store, all my friends were making fun of me because they're like, those Tim Burton movies are garbage. The only real Batman is, you know, Mask of the Phantasm, you know, whatever. And you know,
they did have a compelling argument about Mask of the Phantasm.
No, it's true. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like you look at the trailers for this and they're like, this is going to be terrible. And like, I remember like, because I was like, oh, yeah, I can't wait. And all of them were like, we're not seeing this movie. You know, it's not happening.
Sure.
But I went to see it opening day. My uncle Don took me and my cousin Steve to the North Riverside Theater. We saw it in auditorium number one on opening day. I remember that my uncle had to buy shoes at JCPenney prior to going to see it. I have no idea why I remember that, but
that's
I do.
That's a very specific memory.
Yeah. And, you know, I saw it and I loved it. And, you know, I think a lot of that has to do with just how much I was anticipating it. It was the first time I had seen a Batman movie on the big screen. Oh, actually, that's not true. Because I went to see Mask of the Phantasm on the big screen. That was the first movie I ever went to by myself as a 13-year-old kid. But I wasn't like a huge Batman fan at that point in time, so it didn't really mean anything to me. But this, I was just like in total awe of it, and it became like the movie of the summer for me. I went back and I saw it three more times. You know, I would took my friends to see it, went to see it by myself, you know, everything. And then when the Laserdisc came out, I got that, you know, and I watched that a million times, you know, and yes, it was a really, really, really big part of my summer. And
yeah, absolutely.
Even though everyone was like trashing it, and I, you know, my take on it was sort of like, you know, one of the big criticisms that the comic book guys had about the Burton Batmans is that it was too dark in the sense of, you know, the character of Batman, mainly mm-hmm. the fact that he kills, you know, mm-hmm. and he kills a lot of people in those movies.
He does. He's rather ruthless in his tactics.
And while Batman Forever lightens up the tone quite a bit, it almost seems like it lightens it up to the point of where it should be in terms of the comics.
Well, this is the difficult thing, and I think that Batman Forever is a really, I think it's a really critical point in terms of the understanding of comic book movies, especially by studios and by fans, what they wanted. The 90s saw, I think, a very fertile breeding ground for this type of comic book movie. I mean, and you saw a lot of stuff spawned after this, like, you know, the Phantom and the Shadow and stuff like that, which were much lighter takes where it was the Batman Forever retains enough of that original darkness that you can tell Burton had a hand in developing it. But it's done by somebody with a sensibility and an appreciation informed by actually enjoying the 1960s TV show. And I think that that is what makes Batman Forever so unique. I think it's uniquely enjoyable because it's uniquely terrible. Because it's not like putting peanut butter and chocolate together. You know, it's like putting, I don't know, peanut butter and mustard together. I like mustard and I like peanut butter, but these don't feel right together. You know, this doesn't taste right to me. This doesn't quite work for me, you know, and it's one of those things where, you know, you might get a bite where there's more peanut butter in it. You're like, okay, I can work with this. And then you get, you know, the edge only has mustard on. You're like, okay, I like mustard. But then when you get the two really right up against each other, for instance, the Two-Face in the circus scene, mm-hmm. that's where you get a big mouthful of both and you just, that really leads to a very unpleasant reaction.
Yeah.
You know, like in 95, I did enjoy it. I think a lot of people enjoyed it in the moment, not just because of the anticipation, but because people were ready for something that was lighter in tone. And it was right when Jim Carrey's star, it wasn't just rising. I mean, it was meteorically streaking across the entertainment sky. So it's, you know, and it's 2 hours of Jim Carrey. It was really why people were tuning in. And he's still fun. He's still a great deal of fun to watch in the movie. So, you know.
Yeah, the Jim Carrey thing, I don't know. I was not a big Jim Carrey fan back then. I thought that, you know, things like, you know, I'd see like trailers and stuff for things like Ace Ventura, and I'd just be like, that is not my type of humor. You know, I am, you know,
it's dumb fun, but I like, he still had a lot of cred because of, his turns as like Fire Marshal Bill, on In Living Color
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. Like he had earned a lot of goodwill by being on that show.
Yeah.
Cause he was really like, he was one of the stars of that show. And he continued appearing on it after his movie star kept, like, he honored his contract, basically, which I don't think he would see. He didn't pull a Chevy Chase, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that even if you didn't like Ace Ventura, which I think is just, you know, silly, you know, I haven't watched it in many years, but I remember, you know, it's just him doing funny faces and falling in shark tanks and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, it's just childish humor, but it's still, you know, he was on his way to becoming a big star at the time.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. And that was like a big selling point, you know, for the movie. I mean, Jim Carrey was certainly, I think, the biggest name in that movie. And you know, that was actually something where I was sort of like, it was a deterrent for me. Like, that was the first thing where I was like, I don't know if that's a good idea. You know, the casting of Tommy Lee Jones, I was like, well, it's weird that Billy Dee Williams isn't in this movie.
Yeah.
But I guess if you're not going to have Billy Dee Williams in this movie and you're just casting Two-Face, you know, just, you know, as a character, like, I thought that that was, like, a great choice because, you know, I mean, the thing that I was most familiar with was, you know, The Fugitive, obviously,
right.
Which he just won an Oscar for.
And that's essentially what got him the role, was they wanted to have, you know, a big name in it. And, I mean, Val Kilmer's a big name, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that a worthwhile note is the story has not remained consistent through the years, but basically the way I've always heard the story is that it was in development and then Keaton met with Schumacher and basically said, no, I'm good. I'm out. Yeah. I'm not sticking with this one. And he saw his opening and he saw the direction Schumacher was going to take it. And he was like, no, I'm good. You can get somebody else.
Yeah. And Kilmer, I mean, you say like, oh, Val Kilmer's going to play Batman. And I'm like, oh, I like that casting. Whereas like, if you say Michael Keaton's going to play Batman, I'm like, what? Wait, why? That's so weird.
There was a huge fan revolt back in '89.
Yeah.
People were insisting they weren't going to go see Batman because Michael Keaton was cast in it. And Burton was the one that was like, no, trust me. He can pull this off. He can do it.
Yeah. And Kilmer, you know, he does not really have much to do in this movie at all. You know,
very true.
Yeah. But I was really disappointed with Tommy Lee Jones in this movie. I don't think that it's necessarily Jones's fault. I think it's the way that the character was portrayed. But, you know, coming off of, like, the comics, I was a really big fan of Two-Face. He was one of my favorite characters in the comics.
Same.
And, you know, then to see this up on screen, I'm just like, that doesn't work at all. That's not how I envision this character. And I think that a lot of that was sort of like informed by the presence of Jim Carrey as the Riddler.
It was.
You know?
It was.
I mean, Riddler is a character which I could not care less about one way or the other. But Jim Carrey obviously just took it into Jim Carrey land. And, you know, it is what it is.
Yes. Well, I mean, Jim Carrey is essentially playing the Joker in green in a large sense.
Yeah.
And I think that Tommy Lee Jones, there have been plenty of stories about how he did not get along with Jim Carrey at all on set. And I remember reading an interview with Tommy Lee Jones at the time, because even back when I was had a kinder view of the film and, you know, said, you know, oh, well, you know, I do like it. Like, Two-Face was a sticking point for me. And I remember reading an interview with Tommy Lee Jones, and I think it was shortly before I saw it, where they said, oh, you know, you've won an Oscar. What was it like playing Two-Face, a comic book character? And he essentially said, oh, it's very easy. He's just a simple bifurcated character. And, you know, being the Two-Face fan and the comic book fan that I was, no, that's not him at all.
Yeah.
No, that's not Two-Face at all.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, part of that is just getting rolled into, he didn't want to be upstaged by Carrie.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, okay, so at the time, yes, I did love it, you know, for sure. You know, it was, you know, my number one movie that summer and everything like that. I couldn't get enough of it. But obviously, as time has passed and as, you know, various other incarnations of the character have, you know, popped up and everything like that, my opinion of it has changed a bit, but I'm curious as to how your opinion has changed of it.
I now regard it in the same category as Starship Troopers, where there's so much awful about it that I enjoy watching it just for the sake of mocking it. There was a trip I took not so long ago where I was hanging out with some people, and the guest of honor, it was the beginning of a week-long trip for him, and the guest of honor said, oh, we're going to watch Batman Forever tonight, because he got to decide whatever anybody watched. And I was like, oh, no. But I stayed there, and I watched the whole thing because we just hacked on it the whole time. And, you know, I can't bring myself to hate it, but I can bring myself to hate watch it. I guess you could say. Just again, because it's fun to make fun of, you know, and the early computer graphics and the camera angles with them, John Dykstra should be ashamed of himself. Just going to say that.
Yeah, that stuff didn't work back in 1995, let alone today. But, you know, yeah, for me, I don't know. Like, I definitely, like, I think that if I were to see it today, I'd be like, oh, man, this movie's, you know, not working. But, you know, as, you know, a movie which I have grown up with over the years and everything, there's certainly, like, a nostalgia element to it. But also, like, I can see the things which I really did like back in 95, and those things really do stand out to me as being, you know, quality pieces in a sense, you know? I think that a lot of the action set pieces are really well done. I think that the editing is really solid, and the photography got nominated for an Oscar. You know, I like that...
That actually kind of surprises me.
It is kind of surprising.
I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, but it, you know, the use of color and everything, and you know, the use of angles and stuff like that, which I think is sort of like a throwback to the 60s TV show.
Isn't the term Dutching the camera?
Yeah, like a Dutch angle. Okay. Yeah, you know, that kind of thing. Doing that, using like the primary colors and stuff from the, you know, 66 series, but also making it dark like the new movies, I think that that contrast, that combination is really effective, and I think it's it works, you know. I like the design of the Batmobile and things like that, you know, the set design. I like the fact...
I will admit I like the Batmobile. I'll admit that.
Yeah. And I remember, back then, like, I got these shoes just because they were, like, on sale at Sports Authority, you know, or actually, that time it wasn't Sports Authority, it was something else, it was Sports something. Anyway, Sports Mart, I think that's what it was, Sport Mart. Anyway, regardless, they were Andre Agassi shoes, and they were black, and then, like, the tongue, and, like, underneath the you know, secondary color was like this like aqua blue kind of thing, and they were really comfortable shoes. They were like the best shoes I ever had, and I wish that Nike would re-release them, even though they never have. It's like the Air Tech Challenge LWP or something like that. Anyway, regardless of any of that, none of that matters to the story. The point is that they were black. Very sleek, black, with this aqua marine sort of like tongue and stuff on the sides. And I remember like I was wearing them after seeing the movie, and I was in the comic book store, and my friend Josh saw my shoes, and he's like, I know why you like those shoes so much. They look like the Batmobile.
Well, you know, I can get any defense. I can get any defense of it. I can get the nostalgia angle. I can get the, well, it's, you know, it's the combination of things and stuff like that. But what really I find indefensible about the movie is that score is just awful.
Oh my God.
It's absolutely awful. If you wanted to put me in a CIA black site and torture me with music, you would tie me to a chair and make me listen to that theme song over and over again. Because, and the thing is, I found out years later, and correct me if I'm wrong, because this is the story that I read, was that the whole reason that the soundtrack they released was all rock music was because Schumacher originally only wanted to use a rock and roll soundtrack, but the studio balked and brought in Goldenthal at the last minute, and he like created the score in 13 days or something like that. They just threw him in there, and he's like, okay, I can make some music for you. But that theme is terrible. And especially as a Batman fan who loved Elfman's work on the previous two films, to hear that was, it sets my teeth on edge still to hear it. I don't know why they changed the theme. It doesn't make sense.
I mean, okay, here, let's back this up, because there's like five things there, which I don't know. I never heard the rock score thing. That
I read it years ago. I have no idea how accurate it is.
I mean,
but I remember reading it and thinking it made sense.
It sounds like something that makes sense, you know, so I wouldn't be surprised by that. As far as, you know, the score itself, I mean, I love Danny Elfman's scores for Batman and Batman Returns, for sure. I think they're fantastic. You know, in a lot of ways, I think that, you know, the score for Batman 89 is sort of like the definitive 80s film score, you know? I don't know why. Maybe part of that is the Prince music, which is, you know, interwoven into it or whatever, but that definitely is a great score, for sure, and so is Batman yeah. Returns. But while it's not the same thing by any stretch of the imagination, I think that the score for Batman Forever is amazing.
No.
You know, like, I remember going into a record store, you know, when that album, the Batman Forever soundtrack with, you know, Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me, and, you know, Kiss from a Rose.
Which is a discarded B-side by U2.
Okay,
that was,
all
like,
right.
Laying on their trash heap, and they were like, we need a song. Yeah, here you go.
It's a good song, but regardless, when that...
Oh, it is.
That, when that album was out, and everyone was going crazy over that album... I had to go to the CD Exchange, I think it was the name of it, or I forget the name of the store. Anyway, it's like a sort of like used new record store, like the hip, cool record store in town.
Oh, did they do trade-ins? Did they do credit for your old CDs?
They did trade-ins, but they also had like some weirder stuff. And I was flipping through the soundtracks, and I found the original score, and I took it up to the front, you know, and I'm like, I want this. And they're like, you know, this isn't the one with U2, right? And I'm like, yeah, no, I know. This is the one that I want, you know? And it was amazing. And then just a few months back, they released a deluxe Batman Forever score, like an expanded score with all the stuff on it. Mm. It was amazing. Oh,
yeah, you and I use the word amazing differently, Mike. That much is for sure.
That score is great. But here's the thing about that, right? And the thing that I see, which is sort of like an extension of that, is that unlike movies today where if another director comes onto a series, they try to mimic the style of the director which came before them as much as possible. One of the things that I really like about Batman Forever is that Schumacher got to do his own thing. You know, this is not Schumacher trying to be Burton. It's Schumacher making his version of a Batman movie.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And, I'm rather merciless with it, but I do concede that point. This is his movie. You know, Schumacher made his movie with this. And I think that's win or lose, that's what I'd prefer to see. Like, you know, with all of these different franchise movies that come out, I don't want to go see, you know, like the Marvel Universe stuff. I want to see James Gunn make James Gunn's movie. You know, I want Civil War to look different than Captain America First Avenger. I want the directors to put their own stamp on things, because each movie should be, you know, any film should really be an expression of that director. I mean, yeah, you know, you have the studio system and everything, but in a perfect world, you're bringing a director on because you know that he has some sort of skill set that, you know, it's like, you know, we love to make reference to Empire Strikes Back, all, you know, nerds, geeks, and film lovers do. But, you know what, that conversation between Kershner and Lucas at the very beginning, where, you know, Kershner was like, I don't want to make Star Wars, and Lucas said, no, I want you to make something better, you know, and backed off and said, do your thing, this is your movie.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the thing which is really you know, interesting is that the studio is probably more accepting of it because of the trajectory that Burton had been going in with Batman. I mean, obviously the original Batman, you know, hit the exactly, you know, perfect tone from a studio perspective because it made a boatload of money.
Yep.
But, you know, there was a lot of backlash regarding how dark Returns was, you know?
Well, I mean, you had the Penguin spitting up green bile while he's drowning to death being carried by penguins, you know?
Yeah.
It's the stuff of nightmares for a little kid.
Yeah. And there's a lot of, you know, innuendo and everything. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in that movie where it's like, whoa, this is for kids. Okay. You know, like we're trying to sell Happy Meals, literally, you know? So for, you know, yeah. them to sort of like dial it back for this one and then, you know, see a much greater success, I think is interesting. I mean, the problem that we see, you know, coming with the next movie, which, you know, Goldsman also wrote and Schumacher also directed, is that, you know, the studio saw what worked with Forever and they were like, do that more, you know,
right.
Make it even lighter in tone and basically make it, you know, just like, make it a Happy Meal essentially,
well,
you know?
Batman Forever is caught between two worlds. Batman and Robin is just a complete embrace of the 60s TV show. It's the 60s TV show with a bigger budget and, you know, fuller crew.
Yeah. And it doesn't work.
No,
but
not at all. Nor does this one, Mike. Not really.
I think that this one works well. You know, I mean, I would love to see a director's cut. I'd love to see, you know, what the original script was like, because there was a lot of stuff which was chopped out of this. But, you know, I do love this movie for the nostalgia, but I also think that it does work. I think it is a good movie. It just has some problems in terms of tone and some problems in terms of, you know, maybe being a little too far in one direction, but yes, on the whole, I like it quite a bit.
I would always, you know, and it probably exists or something like that, but I would love nothing more than, I would love to have a conversation actually with Akiva Goldsman, because everybody talks to Schumacher about it. Everybody discusses Schumacher. I want to talk to Goldsman and I want to say to him, okay, this is your first day. You just walked in. What were you told? What were your guidelines? And how did you meet them? What did you do to make this movie happen? Because the simple fact that they had something, and then Goldsman's the one that came in and said, okay, this is the movie Mr. Schumacher wants, and this is what we're going to do. I'm dying to know what that first day was like, what that conversation was like, what his guidelines were.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, I'm assuming he had a relationship with Schumacher because of the client.
Yeah.
For Schumacher to say, like, I'm going to bring in Goldsman to, you know, to rewrite this thing, if that's what happened, you know, I mean, there aren't many similarities between the client and Batman Forever.
Not a whole
aside
lot.
Aside from Tommy Lee Jones, right? Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. You know, obviously Schumacher, you know, saw something there, knew that he would be good for the job, and and this is the result. And, you know, I love it. I know a lot of people give Akiva Goldsman a really hard time for this movie and Batman and Robin, and, you know, perhaps with Batman and Robin it's deserved. I don't think it's deserved with this one at all. I like this one quite a bit. I know that you do, whatever, that's fine.
I would give him an even harder time about Lost in Space, honestly.
You know, I don't have a problem with Lost in Space.
Of course,
you know, honestly, I would give him a harder time about Beautiful Mind than any of these movies.
Okay,
but
look,
you know,
Beautiful Mind didn't. Okay. There's a whole thing there, but like, Lost in Space is Lost in Space, Mike. Come on, that's just
I liked Lost in Space when I saw it. I don't have a problem with Lost in Space.
No, see, whereas, you know, Batman Forever, like, I got caught up in the craze with everybody else and the Jim Carrey-ness of it all, and was like, oh yeah, okay, all right, you know, I'll go along with it. And then through the years, I was kind of like, you know, this doesn't really work. And now I'm just, you know, sort of like outright disliking it. Lost in Space started in a bad place and has gone nowhere but down since then. It's a train wreck.
I guess I haven't revisited it nearly as much as some movies, but when I saw it, you know, like twice in the theater in 1998, I was like, this movie's good, you know? But yeah, I mean, but it is interesting though, because like Goldsman, you know, here obviously was, you know, kind of like doing something, you know, for a director, you know, doing something, it was I think kind of more of an assignment than, you know, let's say a passion project, and he was just getting started and he was, you know, working for a studio. Whereas as he gets further along in his career, you can see like other movies which are, you know, definitely better and definitely more personal. You can see, like, with, let's say, Cinderella Man, and, you know, even I'm going to say like I Am Legend, you know, things like that. I don't know. So yeah, I mean, it's cool. And, you know, he's actually directed a movie himself as well, called Winter's Tale. And
that's the one I've seen a part of it. It was actually really compelling. Like it was one of those ones where I jumped in the middle and I watched all the way to the end, 'cause I got pulled into it.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's cool, you know, now that he's, you know, sort of like much more established, obviously, than he was back in 1995, that we're getting to see, you know, the real Akiva Goldsman, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm excited. I'm super excited that he's working on Discovery, to be honest, you know, probably more than any other person, like including Brian Fuller. And I know that, you know, like a lot of people are like, no, but, you know,
but,
I don't know.
Well, listen, like, you know, one of the things we talk about is him coming on, you know, the way he came on to Forever and stuff like that. He's obviously a guy who works well with others. I think that's what you can learn from his time on Batman, is he was brought in because Schumacher knew that he could get what he wanted from this writer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think they bring Goldsman in unless Kurtzman feels that he can get the, you know, for lack of a better word, the product that they're looking for by working with Akiva Goldsman. They yeah. know that they can talk to him, and Kurtzman can relay to him in shorthand, I'm looking for this, remember this, and we did this. And Goldsman can say, okay, I know how to get there. Let me work with everybody, and we can shape this. We can make this happen. And so I was on that bandwagon at first. It was like, oh, Akiva, Goldsman, Batman Forever, and Batman, rah, rah, rah. But I have come around to your point of view. This is a guy who can deliver what they want. And that's good to know. That means it's going to get done.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, with good results, as, you know, we've seen on Fringe, which is a seemingly similar scenario, you know, in terms of his role on that show. So, all right. It's been fun talking about Akiva Goldsman and his work on Batman Forever today, but that's not all we're talking about on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
And then as kind of a teenager, I kind of drifted a bit from Star Trek, and, you know, I pretended one time when I went to see Star Trek Nemesis that I was actually off to see Elf instead, because that sounded cooler than seeing Star Trek Nemesis. And maybe it still is.
To the journey!
Maybe even playing it with Tuvok, who I think will be brilliant at it, and then it just constantly going brr, brr, like him just getting really annoyed.
Yeah. Tuvok would be the Operation Champ.
Yeah, he would. Yeah.
See, and then the evil holographic doctor from Equinox is singing, you know, the reticular nodes connected to the...
Yes.
Warp 5.
We should get Larry Nemechek on, and we should do a supplemental episode where we just talk and we act like we're Tellarites and we just insult each other for the whole episode.
He would probably love it.
What do you think? I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I don't know. That would be... I might have to get coached by our listeners.
Meta Treks.
And that's the world of language that we live in. It's not this purely referential sense of language. Like when Riker says a minuet, he doesn't just mean, oh, yeah, that thing, minuet, that I can point to, whatever that is on the holodeck, right?
A 17th century French dance. Maybe he wants to dance.
Riker wants to bust a move.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. We'd like to thank our associate producers, Chris Steftenagel, Norman C. Lau, and Jeff Sutter today. If you want to be like Chris, Norm, and Jeff, head on over to patreon.com and become a patron of the network. That's patreon.com/trekfm, patreon.com/trekfm. If you go there, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you leave us a review on iTunes, you will be entered into a contest to win some prizes, which were donated to us by our associate producer, Jeff Sutter. These prizes include a technical manual for Star Trek from the 70s, as well as some blueprints from the 70s that were released back in the day. So head on over to iTunes and leave us a review, and we'll read it on the air and enter you into the contest. If you want to contact us, you can find us on Twitter at TrekFM or our Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. You can also find the Babel Conference on Facebook. That's you just type in the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and we'll pop right up. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me ambling around as Kessel Junkie on different social media networks. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network, co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Matt Rushing. You can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And again, speaking of the Nerd Party Network, co-hosting a show called Great Shot Kid with the inimitable Mike Schindler.
Yeah, you can find me over there. And you can also find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com, where we have some commentaries and other shows. Lots and lots of audio commentaries, over 200, including a commentary for Batman Forever. So go on over there and check that out. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. All right, well, that's it for Batman Forever. We will be back next week to talk about Alex Kurtzman's first directorial effort, People Like Us. ¶¶